name's George Moxery. I'm the Vice President of the Supportive Chapter of the Federalist Society. On behalf of Justin Ferguson, the President of the Supportive Chapter of the American Constitution Society, and Justina Lopez, the President of the Court of Law Republicans, I'd like to welcome you to today's event. Today's debate is entitled D.C. versus Heller and the Future of Gun Control Legislation. We're very pleased to have with us today Alan Gura. Mr. Gura argued the D.C. versus Heller case in front of the Supreme Court and won, striking down D.C.'s gun ban. And he's currently involved in a similar case in Chicago, McDonald versus the City of Chicago, challenging the City of Chicago's handgun ban. Facing him is our very own Dean Bill Traynor, who's a constitutional scholar in his own right, and he'll be taking the other side of the coin. Our old Professor Johnson will be moderating. I'd like to thank the board members of all three groups, the ACS, Federalist Society, and the Fordham Law Republicans, who participated in making this event possible. We have materials down here from all three groups, sign-up sheets for all three, and also some propaganda for you to take from one or both sides, whichever you should be interested in. We've got more propaganda, so. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Professor Johnson.
Welcome to all of you. It is a privilege to be here on the dais with folks who are doing and have done important work in constitutional law. I happen to believe that the topic we're going to be talking about today is one of the most important things that's gone on in the context of the Supreme Court in many years. It tests our commitment to rights, it tests our conception of constitutionalism, and today we will have an opportunity to hear two very smart and informed people talk about a subject that divides the nation in some ways. I will moderate. Our format will be 15-minute presentations by each of the panelists, and we'll have a bit of time after that for rebuttal if it seems appropriate. And after that, we will have hopefully a good bit of time for Q&A, an opportunity for you all to engage the folks on the panel, and I will try to keep too frisky, but it's a place where it's probably appropriate for you to be a bit frisky. So as we start, I think the order is going to be Alan will proceed first, then the dean will follow, and we'll proceed after that as I described. So let's get started.
Thank you so much for having me here. It's a pleasure to be here. Just by a show of hands, how many people here have read the Heller opinions? About everybody. Great. Well, I'm not going to revisit the debate back and forth as to what Justice Scalia had to say versus what Justice Stevens or Justice Breyer had to say. We can all go ahead and read that. But what is important to note is that the Supreme Court did finally resolve the question and decide the Second Amendment is a normal part of the Bill of Rights and secures a meaningful individual right. I will try to address my commentary to what I believe is going to happen next, what I think is the future of Second Amendment litigation, and how this right that's just been announced is going to be applied in the future. The Second Amendment being a normal part of the Bill of Rights, we're not going to have, and we did not get, a case that tells us for all time when the state violates the right to bear arms and when it does not. Just like we don't have one case that for all time tells us what a reasonable search is or when government entangled itself with religion too much. Luckily for us, this is a subject of endless litigation. Cases will come up on a case-by-case basis as fact patterns emerge, and the contours of the law will develop in an organic fashion, just like it does in other constitutional areas. And of course, that means more work for lawyers, and of course, I think we can at least all agree on that, no matter what we believe about the Second Amendment. We can always use more work to do. The first question I'll address, which I think is probably the most important one coming up in the future, is that of incorporation. As you know, it's not enough that we have a right that's been announced by the Supreme Court that defines the federal government. The question here is whether or not this is a right that will also be incorporated as against the states and the local units of government as well. This is particularly important in the gun area because fact is that most gun regulations and gun control and gun prohibition laws exist at the state and local level. There really isn't a whole lot of congressional law that addresses firearms. We have some basic firearms laws, but really most of the action is going to be at the state and local level. So the question becomes, what do we do with the Second Amendment with respect to the 14th Amendment? And here Heller gave us a few clues. In footnote 23 of the majority opinion, the majority noted that it was not decided in incorporation, an issue not before it, but that all the Supreme Court's incorporation precedent, such that it is relating to the Second Amendment, is kind of antiquated and obsolete. There are cases dating back from the 19th century, from the pre-incorporation era, which stated that the Second Amendment does not bind the states, but of course those cases also told us that the First Amendment doesn't apply to the states, that the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments do not apply to the states. Clearly that's no longer the law. Those cases did not anticipate, did not know of the incorporation doctrine that was later announced by the court, and so they don't really speak to the issue. And the court in fact tells us that those cases are somewhat faulty because they lack the required due process analysis, and that word required is the Supreme Court's word, not mine, and that's an important clue. So what is the due process analysis? What is the path to the court case? I'm litigating a case right now in Chicago against that city's handgun ban. Chicago has a handgun ban which is identical to that of Washington, D.C. recently had. That is, all firearms must be registered, and one cannot register a handgun, therefore a handgun ban. There are also other laws in Chicago that the case is challenging that deal with the way in which registration is accomplished in that town. It is not a challenge to registration per se, but we believe that if you're going to have a registration program, then that program needs to comply with basic constitutional standards. It needs to be one that is respectful of the fact that there's an individual right at stake. It can't be arbitrary and capricious, and it can't impose requirements that don't really advance any sort of government goal, but which merely serve to harass and tax what is a fundamental constitutional right. In arguing for incorporation, my case at least, first argues for incorporation under the Privileges or Immunities Clause. The Constitution, the 14th Amendment, its first section, says that states may not enact or enforce any laws that abridge the privileges or immunities of U.S. citizens. And that was intended and meant and understood at the time to do just that, to make sure that the Bill of Rights, as well as other traditional civil rights, were going to be enforced as against the states, and the states could not violate the rights of newly freed slaves and Union veterans and abolitionists and so on. Those people could not be deprived of basic core constitutional rights. In the wake of Reconstruction, it was understood that the old regime of merely having the federal government bound by the Bill of Rights was no longer workable. And that's what the Privileges or Immunities Clause was intended to do. Unfortunately, in the first case interpreting the 14th Amendment, the Slaughterhouse cases, the court read the Privileges or Immunities Clause out of existence. They came up with this funny theory that you only have the privileges or immunities relating to United States citizenship that flow out of American citizenship, such as the right to a passport or diplomatic protection abroad, the right to the navigable waterways of the United States, the right to petition the Congress. And of course, that's not what we fought the Civil War over. Everybody pretty much agrees these days that Slaughterhouse was wrong. Not everybody agrees about the content of the privileges or immunities that are protected by the 14th Amendment. Some people, such as myself, other more libertarian-minded folks, believe that the Privileges or Immunities Clause protects not just the Bill of Rights, but also some very basic fundamental economic rights that were at issue at the time, the right to make and enforce contracts, the right to pursue a livelihood and engage in the common occupations of life. Some of our progressive friends don't necessarily agree that those rights should be fully protected by the clause, but they like other rights that they think need to have a more originalist basis. And so we now have an argument that perhaps abortion and contraception, those types of things, are included in the PRI clause. While there's not an agreement exactly about its full context, most people do agree that at least the Bill of Rights is incorporated by the Privileges and Immunities Clause. And considering the unique history of the Second Amendment and how it was considered at the time that the 14th Amendment was ratified, I believe it would be irresponsible for me not to litigate that question. So my first argument is privileges or immunities, but we don't win on that unless the Supreme Court takes the case and overrules Slaughterhouse, which I believe it should and hopefully one day will. But we don't really need to overturn any long-standing precedent to get incorporation, because of course the Supreme Court has another avenue of incorporation, one which is under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, and the court looks at rights every once in a while on a selective basis, and tries to determine whether or not a right is of such a character or nature such that it should be enforced as against the states with the Due Process Clause as the enforcing mechanism. And the modern test goes something like this. The court looks to see whether the right has a deep historical tradition. Is this a right that's rooted in our system of Anglo-American jurisprudence? Well, the Second Amendment right clearly satisfies that. We have a Supreme Court majority opinion that traces back the history and origins of the Second Amendment right back to Blackstone's England, the original right of self-defense and self-preservation that Blackstone theorized, yielding an auxiliary right to arms with which you could then defend yourself. We have a long record in English courts, even before the Revolution, where the right to arms was considered to be an individual fundamental right. After all, it was secured by the 1689 Declaration of Rights. There was some debate, but that debate was resolved. I know not everybody likes it was resolved, but it's been resolved. This was the concept that was embodied in the Second Amendment, and so we know it has a deep historical tradition. Next, the court looks to see whether or not this is a right that states have traditionally respected, and if so, what has been the trend in the states? And here again, we see that this is a right that was demanded by all of the five states that demanded a Bill of Rights during the ratification process. Every state that had a Bill of Rights at the time had a right to arms in its constitution. And we now have 44 states that have a Second Amendment analog in their constitution, and the trend has been over the years to add and strengthen and invigorate those constitutional provisions. And so the trend in the state treatment has been a positive one. Again, I think that that's something we're not going to be worried about. But I think the most important factor in the analysis is the court's examination of the nature of the right. What is this? Is this the right that has this, the kind of character that we normally would expect to see incorporated under the meaning of the term liberty? And here, again, I think we win. What do we know about the Second Amendment after Heller? The Second Amendment is rooted in the tradition of self-defense and self-preservation. It's a right that's central to bodily integrity and personal autonomy. And we have a lot of rights that are incorporated against the states because they are also rooted in bodily integrity, personal autonomy, the right to, as the court said in Casey versus Planned Parenthood, the right to define one's own concept of existence. Well, if you have the right to define your own concept of existence, and that means you have a right to choose to terminate your pregnancy, your concept of existence may include resisting a violent criminal attack, so you can continue to exist. And you should have the right which speaks to that interest. Just like you also have the right to abortion, contraception, the right to refuse medical treatment, the right to engage in personal intimate relationships with other people, regardless of the state's judgment on that. All these are rights that that speak to that interest. And so I think on all fours, it's a slam dunk going down all the factors. We have substantive due process incorporation. And once we get that going, then I think you're going to see more and more interesting Second Amendment litigation because, of course, that's where most of the controversial laws live. We have seen a great deal of follow-up that people have made in the Heller case that's been of the kitchen sink variety. And by that I mean you have a bank robber or a drug dealer who hears that there's a right to arms, and so they'll throw that in against the inevitable felon in possession of a gun count and the like. And, of course, in Heller, there is that paragraph that tells us that ban on felons possessing firearms is presumptively constitutional, and the courts are simply not going to revisit that. So we've seen a lot of what I would call the sort of garbage litigation that sort of tilts at the windmills of the things that are presumptively constitutional, things that are not controversial. But as we get into incorporation, we're going to see litigation that addresses more interesting state laws. And what's the standard review going to be? And that leads me to the next topic. Well, Heller was sort of an absolutist case in the sense that the court said, you have a right, you have a law that forbids the exercise of the right, the two don't match, and that's the end of the story, regardless of the standard of review that might be applied. And that's the correct approach to Heller. Heller is a case that could be and was resolved based on mere constitutional interpretation. You know what this provision means, and it means something that is not compatible with what D.C. wanted in the case. But a lot of cases are going to be decided not as a matter interpretation, but as a matter of construction. And the fact of the matter is that a lot of modern gun laws don't really have framing era roots in them. The felon ban is one such example. Yet at the same time, we just know that the court is not going to tell us that just because it wasn't done back in the day, that it's not going to be done today, given the fact that, that we've discovered new challenges and have new applications for many modes of American life. And so in footnote 27, the court told us, harking back to Carolyn Products in footnote 4, that the Second Amendment's an enumerated right, and it's going to receive the same sort of extra care that the court has given other enumerated rights as opposed to unenumerated rights. And again, that's the basic structure of Carolyn Products, well-established way of approaching the Constitution. So while we don't know whether or not we're going to get necessarily strict scrutiny or undue burden, it's going to be something like that. It's going to be a test where it will no longer be enough for the government to simply hypothesize or assert some kind of a law enforcement rationale for a gun law. They're going to have to demonstrate that a law actually does have some kind of actual beneficial effect, and that it's narrowly tailored in such a way to achieving that effect and no more. Many laws will survive this. Again, the ban on lunatics and felons having guns. I don't think that you could possibly say the state has no interest in enacting those laws or in saying that those laws or their simple analogs like instant background checks are unconstitutional. Clearly those laws are going to pass because an instant background check to determine whether or not you're a lunatic doesn't really impede your interest in having arms, but it serves a very important compelling state interest. However, other laws that don't seem to achieve much are not going to survive. Laws, for example, like the one I'm challenging in Chicago, that requires a gun not just to be registered, but re-registered constantly. Almost as soon as you register it, you have to start the process again, because it's an annual process. It must be started 60 days in advance. And each time, you have to do the whole thing over again. Photographs, fingerprints, paying a tax. That's excessive. I think it's enough to have a law like Chicago has, which simply says, if you're going to move or dispose of your gun, tell us about it. And that will serve the state interest in registration, whatever that interest might be. There's really no need to impose an impermissible annual tax on the exercise of a fundamental right. So that's the kind of law I think is going to be very easy to strike down. There are other types of laws that fall in a different category that I don't think I have time to address, and that's the category of what is protected, because that's not really a standard review question. It's the kind of question we had in Heller with respect to the handgun ban. We know, for example, that there are many types of speech which are undeniably speech, but they're not protected speech. For example, perjury, or extortion, or terrorist threats. Those are speech, but they're not going to be protected. And likewise, there is a test in Heller for which arms are protected and unprotected. And if an arm is protected, and handguns are a class of arms that none are protected, then you can regulate them, provided that the regulations comport with whatever level of review you have, that you can no longer have an absolute ban. At the same time, if there were a class of arms that are not within the ambit of the right, then the government can do what it wants to with them, and we can all hypothesize which arms would easily fall in those kinds of a prohibited category where legislation might be plenary. And finally, in the 30 seconds I have left, I should address another topic which I think is of interest to a lot of people these days, and that is that Heller exposed something that those of us who are more frequent visitors to the Federal Society have been aware of for a long time, and that is that on the legal right, at least, there's a real split of opinion between people who take the more Borkian, Posner-type view that courts must be deferential and not interfere and give individual rights a very narrow construction because the legislative process isn't one that's, after all, a democratic one, and that's what the people want. Might as well give the people what they want. And those of us who believe in a more rights-oriented version of the Constitution. And under that vision, and I think this is the vision supported better by originalism and by the Federalist Papers and all these things that conservatives like to look at, the framers intended and did indeed enact a Constitution where the judges do get to say what the law is, and they do not defer to the legislature or the president in applying and securing individual liberty. If you read Federalist 78, for example, Hamilton wrote in so many words that the legislature is just that place where cabals and conspiracies by factions occur against individual liberty. And it was thought that the way we check that sort of political problem is by having a judiciary that's independent, a judiciary that doesn't stand for election, a judiciary that doesn't have term limits, one that whose salary can't be cut, and one that gets to have judicial review, the judicial powers referenced in Article 3. And everybody knew what that meant at the time. I do not believe that there is any special role for the courts to play in deferring to the will of the democratic process. What the courts should do, and whether it's guns or other rights, so long as there's a right that exists, once that exists, that's the end of the game. The court's job is to enforce that right and apply it, actually engage in the Constitution, and there's really no need to pay much attention to the political branches after that's occurred. I think my time is up. I will sit down.
Well, I have to say it's a rare privilege for deans because we don't usually get to think about stuff. So I was delighted to get this invitation from Federalist Society and from ACS and the Fordham Republicans. And it's a real pleasure to be here today with somebody who's done so much to shape the law, and with Professor Johnson, who really has done so much to put this issue on the table. When I was in law school, it was just clear, really beyond peradventure, that the Second Amendment was limited in scope, that it was about the right to be part of a militia and have guns as part of a militia. And really, any kind of alternate argument was really just treated as silly. In the 20 plus years since then, there's been a substantial body of scholarship. And bracketing the issue of the way in which the case law has moved, substantial body of scholarship that has really put the issue on the table and really, made the argument for an individual right that goes beyond something that is part of being a militia. It's put that on the table and made the case for it. What I want to do here, so I want to acknowledge the importance of that argument and its effectiveness. What I'm going to do is, in my time, I'm going to talk about Heller and why Heller was wrongly decided. The Stevens dissent, which is that the Second Amendment is adopted to protect the right of the people of each of the several states to maintain a well-regulated militia, is right. And the majority's view that it's about a broader individual right to firearms is not right. And I do that from the perspective of originalism, which is kind of my take on the Constitution. I'm usually thought to be a liberal originalist, which puts me in a category that's basically me and Professor Flaherty. Has now really kind of mobilized the nation. It's based on the idea that originalism is the best touchstone of constitutional interpretation. Because it is most consistent with the majoritarian decision-making of we the people. We the people adopted the Constitution, adopted the Bill of Rights, adopted all the subsequent amendments, and that should be the basis of constitutional interpretation by the courts and by the legislature and by the executive today. Now, what are we interpreting here? We're interpreting the Second Amendment. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So that's the text we're looking at. Now, the first question, I think, for an originalist is, what's the prism through which you view that? Mr. Gura talked about how the original understanding was that judges wouldn't defer to legislatures when they engage in judicial review, and I would disagree with that. There's kind of a common view that Marbury creates judicial review. That's in some sense kind of created out of whole cloth in 1803 by Marshall, and that's not right. And so then we're in agreement. But if you look at the case law before Marbury in the period between the ratification of the Constitution and Marbury in 1803, There's actually a very substantial body of case law, federal and state, in which courts strike down statutes. So there's both judicial review and a particular approach to judicial review. In large part, it's deferential. Justice Iredell on the Supreme Court enunciates what's known as the clearly unconstitutional test. And that is the dominant approach. The exception is in structural areas. Courts strike down statutes that limit powers of juries, that limit or affect the power of courts. That's really what Marbury is about. And federal courts strike down state statutes that undercut the power of the national government. So judicial review is in general deferential, with the exception of these limited structural areas in which courts are really trying to protect political actors that can't protect themselves. Juries, courts, and the national government is being protected against state governments. Okay? So that's what judicial review is about. So when you apply judicial review and the original theory of judicial review to gun control legislation, to Second Amendment, it's an area of deference. This is the kind of statute that courts would uphold unless it was plainly unconstitutional. And a statute like the DC gun control statute is not plainly unconstitutional. So that's kind of the overall, the prism. Judicial review in this area, deferential. Okay, then now we move towards kind of the substance of it. Again, the text, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Okay. Now how do we interpret that text? And I think really one of kind of the crucial threshold questions is, you know, you've got a preface. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. That's the preface. And then you go into the right conferral, the right of people keeping their arms shall not be infringed. Now, and this is a big dividing point in Heller. Justice Scalia, for the majority, says, well, the precedent, you know, you have an English right, which he reads broadly, and the preface explains why, of all of the English rights that are out there, why this particular one is being protected. But the preface doesn't limit the right. So really, when you're interpreting the right itself, you don't focus on the militia part of the clause. Whereas the dissenters say the preface is important. You know, you read it all together. Now, one thing actually, again, you're the expert in this. One thing that actually strikes me is when I was reading in preparation for this, the literature, a number of points say that this is the only preface in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. And it's not. So, for example, one thing that I've written on is the Intellectual Property Clause, which also has a preface. And it is to promote the progress of science and the useful arts, to promote the progress of science and the useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. Okay, so that if you look at this as the analog to the Second Amendment, the right is Congress can create limited rights for limited periods of time. And the preface is the part that says to promote the progress of science and the useful arts. Okay. And usually when we interpret this, and I think correctly, you know, we give way to the preface. You know, so Congress can't, for example, there's case law which I would say is consistent with the original understanding. A recent case in which the phone book, you know, could Congress create a copyright protection in the phone book? It's a writing, but there's no creativity. And Congress has said, and the court has said, you can't do that partly because we give way to the preface. And I think that's appropriate here as well. You give way to the preface. And that, I think, is, again, consistent with the dissenters. This is about a militia-based right. Now then you look at constitutional history. Okay. So stage one, and again, I think when I look at the constitutional history, what I think is the most relevant is you start with 1776. You know, you start with the early Bills of Rights, then you move forward to our Constitution, the Bill of Rights. My focus, I mean, I can talk in the question and answer about it if it comes up, but my focus, unlike, say, Scalia's in the majority, is not on English practice prior, because I think it's concerned with a different set of questions and a different constitutional theory. So you look at the first Bill of Rights, and most of them, not all of them, but most of them are really concerned about militias. So we have Virginia, that a well-regulated militia composed of the body of the people trained to arms is the proper, natural, and safe defense of a free state. That standing armies in time of peace shall be avoided is dangerous to liberty, and that in all cases the military should be under strict subordination to and governed by the civil power. Okay, the analog is not a right to bear arms in the Virginia Bill of Rights. It's about the militia. The same is same we have in Delaware and Maryland. Okay, they're about militias, not about the right to bear arms. Now then, when we have the right to bear arms, which we have in some of the states, in two of the cases, it is tied in with defense. So we've got North Carolina. The people have a right to bear arms for the defense of the state. They have a right to bear arms for the defense of the state. Massachusetts. The people have a right to keep and to bear arms for the common defense. For the common defense. It's not an individual right. It's not about self-protection. It's about for the common defense. Now, this is the dominant view. The militia-based view is dominant. Now, I would say, you know, it's not everybody's view. And I think one of the things that lawyers have a tendency to do, and historians as well, is when they're arguing for a specific side, they say, everybody thought this. I think there is evidence for the individual right that's a broader right than a militia-based right in 1776, and particularly in Pennsylvania. That the people have a right to bear arms for the defense of themselves and the state, for the defense of themselves. Now, Pennsylvania is really considered, if you read, as some of you had, Gordon Wood's Creation of the American Republic, you know, Pennsylvania in a lot of ways is an outlier of the first state constitutions. But I think it does have this text that could be read, there's an argument about it, but it could be read as an individual right. That goes beyond the militia-based right. That's about self-defense. And Vermont, which is actually not a state, has broken away from New York and is kind of hopes to be a state someday. Actually, I think if Heller, Scalia relies on Vermont, never tells you it's not a state at this point, but it's not. I don't mean to offend any Vermonters, but it's not. They largely copied the Pennsylvania Constitution when they draft their own Bill of Rights. Not totally, but largely. So the bottom line is when you look at 1776, 1777 through 1780, kind of the first period, it's really about militias and it's about common defense, not an individual right of self-protection. Fast forward. What happens? The Constitution has a clause on militias. To provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively, the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. Now, what a lot of the anti-federalists, the opponents of the Constitution, are concerned about is that this is a kind of a way for the federal government to essentially gut the state militias. So George Mason, who's the great anti-federalist, says, the militia may here be destroyed by that method which has been practiced in other parts of the world before. That is by rendering them useless, by disarming them. Under various pretensions, Congress may neglect to provide for arming and disciplining the militia, and the state governments cannot do it, for Congress has the exclusive right to arm them. Okay. And this is one instance of the overall anti-federalist take, which is that the Constitution vests too much power in the federal government and compromises the power of the state. And so when you look at most, again, most but not all, of the state proposed Bill of Rights, they resonate with the theme of militias rather than with the theme of individual right of self-protection. For example, Virginia, which is that the people have a right to keep and bear arms, that a well-regulated militia composed of the body of the people trained to arms is the proper, natural, and safe defense of a free state. The standing armies are dangerous to liberty and therefore ought to be avoided as far as the circumstances and protection of the community will admit, and that in all cases the military should be under strict subordination to and be governed by the civic power. It's about militias. Now again, not all. New Hampshire is the exception. New Hampshire says, 12th, their proposal. Congress shall never disarm any citizen unless such as are or have been in actual rebellion. So the weight of the anti-federalist concerns is about militias and the protection and preservation of the state militias, with New Hampshire as an outlier. And then when Madison drafts it, he follows here, as he does often, the Virginia model. And so he has, his text is, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, a well-armed and well-regulated militia being the best security of a free country, but no person religiously scrupulous of bearing arms shall be compelled to render military service in person. It's about, as actually the conscientious objector clause highlights, it's about participation in the military. Okay. So my time is almost up, but let me just kind of get the basic themes. First of all, for an originalist, step one is power of the courts, which is limited. Largely deferential in the exercise of judicial review, and this is an area in which courts are deferential. Two, dominant background assumption of the first state constitution focuses on a militia-based right. Not always, but the dominant one. The anti-federalist critique is about the power of the federal government vis-a-vis the states, which again is concerned with the protection of the militia. Most of the state proposed amendments look like that, and that's what Madison is trying to do. Okay? All of which supports that on balance, the militia-based approach is the one that has more evidence on its side. And then when you add the deference to that in a case of ambiguity, then it becomes totally clear. But frankly, it's clear without it. Okay, thank you.
I'll take about 2 minutes of rebuttal, maybe four, and we'll open up to Q&A. I have to say, I completely disagree with this version of history, which I don't believe has actual support in the historical record. I know people disagree about this, but let me briefly go over some of the points. The anti-federalists were concerned about certain aspects of the Constitution, and they wanted a Bill of Rights to address those things that they felt needed to be secured. The Federalists, of course, though, won the election. They controlled the first Congress. They got the Constitution ratified. And the Federalists were in charge, and the person in charge, of course, was Madison, who is so Federalist, he's even the silhouette of the Federal Society. He was the most radical of the Federalists, and so the Bill of Rights that he wrote was going to be the Bill of Rights, and it was the Bill of Rights, which addressed things that were not going to be controversial. Of course there was a right to free speech, a right to worship, a right against search and seizure, a right to arms. These were not controversial topics. What was controversial? Anything that would alter the structure of the new Constitution that had just been ratified. The idea that they went to all this trouble to write the Constitution and then immediately would alter the balance of military power between the state and the federal governments, it's laid out in Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 15 and 16, simply defies credulity. And in fact, there is nothing in the historical record, not one statement by anybody, ever, anywhere, announcing once ever a militia concept of the Second Amendment as announced by the dissent. Not until sometime later, primarily in the 20th century, did people create the sort of militia-based concept of the Second Amendment. And in fact, the point of view that was so dominant 20 years ago that the dean was discussing was not the point of view that was addressed by the city in our case. It used to be that the precedents would say, well, the Second Amendment secures the right of the state to arm a militia, the right of the state to have some sort of military unit. That's not what what the city argued in this case, and it's not what Justice Stevens even even adopted in his dissent. About 15 years ago or so, the other side to this debate gave up the idea of the state's right to have a militia, and instead they agree with us now that it's an individual right. Of course, there's that pesky phrase in the Second Amendment, the right of the people, the same right of the people which is found in the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the same people who have rights in the Ninth Amendment, and so on. They gave up the idea that you could possibly say that the right of the people is really not a right of the people, but somehow the right of the state. So instead they posited a new vision, which is, well, yes, it's a right of the people, but one which can only be exercised at state direction and control. And so it's a public purpose right, or a sophisticated collective right. Basically, the individual right to do what you're told by your state military unit. A difficult concept of a right, not one that has any grounding in history or the record, and in fact was rejected now in Heller for hundreds of pages of reasoning, which we can all read later. If you look at the proposals that the state sent to the Congress, the states that demanded a right to arms, it was crystal clear that they were talking about an individual right to arms. Virginia, for example, made two lists of amendments, and it's true that they made a demand to re-alter the militia powers. That is, they wanted the state to have more control over a military unit, and that was the 11th Amendment that was proposed in what they called other amendments. But in the same document, they have a list called Bill of Rights. And under the Bill of Rights Amendment, they had the Second Amendment language, and that was paragraph 17 of the proposal that came out of the Virginia Convention. So here you have Virginia proposing a Second Amendment-type amendment, and also a militia-type amendment of the kind which was argued by the dissent. Now, why would Virginia do the same thing twice in the same document? Obviously, these things had different meaning, and indeed, at the time, everybody understood that the militia was not going to be some club or some unit of government. The militia simply referred to those people who were capable of bearing arms in order to bring about public order or defend the state in time of catastrophe or invasion or some other problem. Because there were no standing armies, there were no organized military units, there was no calling 911, there was no sheriff's department, there was no municipal police. The fact is that people had arms. It was understood that this was a basic tool of life that people would have, and then people could act as militia using their own arms, privately supplied, when the call came out, in fact, to do so. Which is why all of the early decisions interpreting some of these, what the dean calls the militia clauses of the early state constitutions, actually found that those secured an individual right. If you look at the early decisions of the Massachusetts State Supreme Court, the North Carolina Supreme Court, they all agreed that even though there was some of this common defense type language, some of this militia language in their state constitutional analogs, that what was discussed actually was an individual right to arms that was applied and given weight and meaning throughout the early American period by those states. I found particularly interesting the discussion of the copyright and patent clause. I actually do practice intellectual property once in a while, but I'm not doing Second Amendment material. That's the other folks that I practice. In 2003, the Supreme Court abolished any meaning that the preamble to the IP clause has. In Eldred v. Ashcroft, we had a challenge to the so-called Mickey Mouse Act, the Sonny Bono Copyright Extension Act. And for those of you who follow these issues, basically, Mickey Mouse and his friends were about to head into the public domain, which was very upsetting to a lot of large corporate interests that have a lot of valuable intellectual property that they wanted to keep securing. And so they got Congress to honor the memory of Sonny Bono by extending the terms of existing copyrights. And of course, some people sued and said, this is crazy. It does not serve the progress of science and useful art to extend a monopoly to something which was already created 70 years ago. You're not providing Uncle Walt with any further incentive to draw cartoon characters. He's been dead for a long time. And so this is not actually, not only is it not a limited time, if you keep extending time, but it also doesn't serve the purpose of promoting progress in science. And both the D.C. Circuit and the Supreme Court basically said, actually, for Congress to decide what promotes progress, we're not going to use that as a limiting principle in too many ways. And likewise with the term limited time. And also with respect to the telephone book case, now you cannot just photocopy the telephone book. You will be sued for copyright. The information is in the public domain. That is, you can make your own phone book That is, the Copyright Act does not protect facts or ideas. It protects expressions. So the phone book, if it's a mode of expression with a page number and subheadings and an information which is arranged in a certain way, cannot be photocopied and sold in the street. However, you can read the phone book, get that information, and make of it what you will. The fact that it's contained in a phone book doesn't mean that information is somehow protected by copyright. And that's a distinction that we copyright lawyers talk about. I just wanted to clear that up in case any of you work in those areas, which are somewhat different. But the preamble to the Copyright and Patent Clause is not any more limiting than the one in the Second Amendment, or for that matter, the preamble to the Constitution itself. You cannot go to court and say that an act of Congress does not establish justice or secure the blessings of liberty. It doesn't work. The court said that that's flowery language. It's nice. But the court has always followed the traditional way that we approach preambular language in statutory constitutional text, which is to say that only if there is some ambiguity in the operative clause do you look to the preamble to help you interpret it. But when the words of the operative clause are clear, you ignore the preamble. And that is an ancient way of construing statutes that existed in the English Parliament, in the English courts, in the early American system, and it's with us through today. And so the right of the people to keep their arms shall not be infringed. Sounds pretty clear to most people. You don't look to see whether the preamble, in fact, alters or shapes that, although, as Justice Scalia's opinion does correctly, the two clauses are harmonious. Using ordinary accepted modes of English grammar, the first clause tells you a reason, not an exclusive reason, not an exclusive purpose, but tells you why you have a right to arms. At least it's one reason. Why? Because if you don't have arms, you can't function as militia, because of course militia is composed of everybody using their own arms. And I think with that we should probably open up the questions. Yes.
I will, to the degree that I can see you from here, identify folks who have questions and we'll have at it.
I'll start. This one is mainly for the dean. The Supreme Court, starting in a series of cases that began in 1820, the latest one being in 1990, held that federal power over the over the state militias is plenary. How does that fit with your view of what the Constitution of what you just described the Constitution? Of what you just described, the role of the Second Amendment being. And one particular example that comes to mind is 1955 Little Rock, where the Arkansas governor called out the National Guard. The president federalized them, and that was the end of that story. And there was no Second Amendment defenses came up with that.
It's an interesting question. I haven't thought about. And I guess the first point I'd make is that when we're looking at constitutional interpretation, you can 1820s is very different from 1791. Mr. Gura talked about a lot of the kind of early cases and how they interpreted the individual right. It's a little bit like when my son was small, he used to have the phrase "olden times." Olden times would be, he was about three, so 4 years ago would be olden times, and when the dinosaurs roamed the earth, that would be olden times also. I think he always thought of my life as spanning olden times. So what you can have in the 1820s with respect to kind of a broad understanding of the scope of the federal control over the militia doesn't necessarily track where they were in 1789. Other than that, I'm not familiar with the line of cases.
Well, I think it's a great question. Let's talk about 1865, because that's really when that was resolved. I mean, the idea that the states have a right to a military unit with which to check federal power, that ended at Appomattox Courthouse. And you saw that. And in fact, 2 years earlier, in 1863, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, for a brief period of time, enjoined the Union draft of Civil War soldiers. They quickly changed their mind, which I think we're all glad of. There was a concurring opinion in that case, first time around, where a justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said, "Oh, the Second Amendment gives the states the right to control people who would be in the militia, and therefore the Union can't draft those people." But you're right. One of the reasons why there was a debate back in 1789 and even a little bit afterwards about the extent of federal power over the militia is because the Anti-Federalists did not want the new federal government to have the exclusive military authority in the United States. They liked the idea that the states, if they didn't quite like how the deal was working out, could retain some authority over a military unit. And that's not what James Madison had in Article 1, Section 8. And it was not changed in the Second Amendment. And the attempt to do that was defeated in 1865. And it's still not the law today. The other way of looking at the Second Amendment from the other side is, okay, it's not a state right to have a military to check the government with. What if it is the people's ability to have a right to arms within the context of militia duty? Well, what that implies is nullification. It's kind of similar. It channels Senator Calhoun, right? The governor of this state could declare that you're all in the militia, as indeed you all under the unorganized militia of the state of New York. And pursuant to that, the state's Second Amendment authority, you need not follow federal gun laws anymore. So you can have fully automatic weapons or bazookas or whatever the governor of New York wants you to have, because that's a Second Amendment right to give you, the militia of New York, the right to those weapons, never mind what federal law has to say. That would be the other construction of the Second Amendment from the other side. I think it's equally untenable.
But, I would just say, if you're an originalist, the real question is, how did they understand things in 1789, 1791? It's not how did they understand them in 1865. That's the first point. And then the second point is, was Madison departing in the Second Amendment from his understanding of the militia clause of the federal constitution? Yeah. I mean, I think if you look at, Madison is very hesitant about proposing a Bill of Rights. He says initially it's unnecessary. It's not a reworking of things, kind of the overall framework as he understood it. It's really an enunciation and clarification of the way in which he read the Constitution.
What was the name of the case, the Pennsylvania case?
It's cited in our brief. And by the way, for people who if these handouts are not sufficient, if you visit dcguncase.com, go to the case filings page. And you will see all the briefs in the case, our briefs, the city's brief, all 67 amicus briefs, as well as the relevant pleadings in the court below. So it's a great library for anybody to research. Virtually everything that's been thought about the Second Amendment is going to be in one of those briefs, wherever you believe or want to explore. But that's cited in our brief. I forget the case.
Whatever you think about Heller, it is the law. My question is, based on, not on whether you agree with Heller, but what you think Supreme Court will do and what standard of review you predict they will use, whether New York's current gun laws are passed laws.
Which gun laws?
The state of New York gun laws.
Some of them will survive and some of them won't. There's so many of them. If you can make a more specific question, I'd be happy to answer my best guess.
You would say that some of them would fail.
Some of them would fail and some of them won't. In New York, at least, we need to wait for the Supreme Court to resolve the issue, because in 2004, the Second Circuit, in a case called Bach versus Pataki, held that we don't really know what the Second Amendment means, but whatever it means, it's not incorporated. And so we're going to need the Supreme Court to step in before you can see a challenge in New York, at least one that's going to get this far, considering how recent and authoritative the Second Circuit is.
Now, would you say that the D.C. law was an extreme law?
The D.C. law was a very extreme law, right? About
that. To get to your question, I think, so Heller is the law, right? I do also think that, one of the things that law students generally should be thinking of is, how malleable constitutional law is over time. I think Heller is a departure from the way the case law was before. So, as you're thinking through these questions, don't look at Heller as dispositive. Think through, is it rightly decided? Because, something like this is going to be in play for all of your careers. That's the first point. Then the second is, how far do we read Heller? And that's something that we don't know right now, right? I think one question is the incorporation question that you talked about. But the other question is, this is a pretty, this was a smart test case. My hat's off to you. You know, you picked one that was a very extreme case, and, you know, as you're trying to pick up that fifth vote, this is the kind of case, this is the kind of statute that you want. You know, it doesn't tell you so much about whether the next statute is going to be invalidated, because it's not within the ambit of this, you know, very extreme statute.
Well, I would disagree with that. I think as a litigator, you should take the Supreme Court's word on this as dispositive. If you're advising, trying to pass the bar exam as a question, or if you're advising a local government, or perhaps even federal government, and your attorney fees are on the line, because you're going to lose a civil rights case, and Section 1988 is in play. Don't say, well, this is Supreme Court, and that's theory. No, it's going to be applied in a real heavy-duty way. Whatever the issue is, you know, the worst thing is to get into a district court, and the judge says, well, there's a Supreme Court case, and I believe this is controlling them. And you're not going to get very far beyond that. And the courts love to decide cases based on precedent. It makes their job easy. Professors like to think of things as complicated because they can write a lot of articles. Judges aren't like that. They have workloads, they have dockets, and they have to control these things. And if they can get rid of something because that's what the precedent says, that's how they're going to decide it. I'd be very careful before pretending the Supreme Court doesn't really mean what it says, because the district judges were going to be that in the civil court.
That's actually not what I said.
Oh, yeah.
So let me just be clear. One of the things that's great about what you're doing as the ACS and the Federalist Society and the law school Republicans, you're grappling with fundamental issues. And I think it's important to realize how, when you get to the Supreme Court, how malleable the law is. You know, 15 years ago, I had a student who was writing a law review note, and he was saying that the statute that the Supreme Court struck down in Lopez was unconstitutional. And I said, the law is clear. And it was clear at the time. But people brought the test case because they thought the court is shifting and you can challenge this precedent. And so, that's one point that's very important for you all to recognize, particularly when you're in 5-4 zone. So that second, but Heller is the law right now. So, your task on both sides is to figure what the next step is. But again, as you think that through, as you're advising a client, as you're mounting test litigation, I think it's important to recognize that it was a well-brought test case that targeted a statute that was pretty extreme. So it doesn't tell you what a more limited gun control statute, whether it will pass muster or not.